The reason why I'm here today is to open up a dialogue which I think had lain dormant for a while with the Committee on Human Factors. I have known about this committee in its various forms for some time. I've only been at the Office of Naval Research for a little over a year now, and I did spend about 9 years there in the 90s. And my job as a department head is to be sure that we know in the Rumsfeldian sense what we don't know. And so, you know, the Office of Naval Research, you know, we're really in the business of discovery, both by as a funding agency in creating new fields, being a channel for innovation in the Department of Defense and Department of the Navy, and also as being an agent of discovery for Navy and Marine Corps interests. And we're in that special place, which is a very interesting place between basic research and applications. And in the medical area, really taking this to heart, we're saving lives, and we're dealing with people who have horrendous injuries, psychological, physical, and we work in a tri-service environment. It's a little complicated, but it really is very meaningful, and I think it's very important work. I do want to say that you know, our quality control of the research that we sponsor and the information that we provide as agents of discovery, if you will, for Navy and Marine Corps folks, really is in the hands of the program officers. And our program officers, unlike NIH, NSF, in some of our programs have a certain degree of discretion and ability to make decisions and make things happen that really can't happen in many other places. And I think that's a strength of the federal organization, is that we have such diversity of models of supporting research. So, but I, again, my job as a manager of those folks now is that I have to make sure that they're connected. And that, so I'm thinking that maybe by establishing contact with this committee, that would be one way that I can make sure that we're, you know, that I'm aware of what's going on out in the world beyond the computer interface of the individual program officer who sits in his office and looks at the world through their electronic eyes and ears. So what I thought I would do today is basically introduce myself and also introduce ONR and introduce my department, which is called Warfighter Performance Science and Technology. I'm not sure exactly where we're going to go from here, but I just want to give you a sense of what we think is exciting. I see a lot of opportunities, and I wanted to just lay those on the table at your feet and maybe get your reactions or build a further dialogue afterwards. Yeah, one other point I want to make, but let's just move on. So the front end of this is what do we do at ONR? As I mentioned, we are more or less agents for the Navy and Marine Corps. We do have applied problems that make a difference that can benefit by perhaps high-risk approaches that wouldn't be supported, for example, by industry. In fact, one of the big efforts that we have in science and technology, which has a very specific congressional meaning, basic research to advanced technology demonstrations, one of our big jobs is to shake out risk as we explore innovative approaches. But we're also in a position of influence in providing you know, the art of the possible to Navy and Marine Corps. So thinking about what are the problems that we're facing today that people who've been living the Navy and Marine Corps life for the last 10, 20 years aren't really aware of that we're experiencing. You know, one of the things by way of introduction for myself is that I've had sort of a checkered career in a sense. I've had a lot of different jobs. My background is in behavioral neuroscience, so I've done human neuropsychology with people with brain injuries. I've done animal models of learning and memory and self-organizing systems. Then I worked for the Austin Naval Research, where I got started a program in cognitive neuroscience back in the 90s, and then got more involved with virtual environment technologies for training systems, immersive technologies, and what Bob Beaton, I think, would call human systems integrations, or the systems approach to individual and team decision making, in particular aboard our surface ships. And I was doing that with my colleague Bob Bost and Bob's current boss, Trish Hamburger, in a program that we had back in the 90s. Then I got a job at the NASA Ames Research Center out in Silicon Valley, where we were really embedded in information sciences and technology group that had a lot of connectivity to the robotic space exploration program. We had a strong partnership with the Jet Propulsion Laboratory on the Mars Exploration Rover missions, for example. And then I went back to NASA headquarters, because that's where the money was. And as a lab manager, you have to know where the money is. I created a human systems integration program there, in part because of my experience in the 90s of working in the Navy and helping, being part of a movement that identified human systems integration as an essential component to systems engineering. And so we were part of the movement that got the human systems engineering, human systems integration into the acquisition of defense systems Bob Beaton was talking about earlier. And when I was at NASA headquarters, part of the human space exploration, there was a big emphasis on systems engineering as an approach to building the kind of the replacement for the shuttle for the next mission. This was after President Bush announced the vision for space exploration, which I think was a really great idea. I got a nice program in HSI sold, got my budget doubled, and then a new administrator came at NASA, and all my leadership got sacked. So I ended up looking for jobs, and the job I ended up with was working with Paul Kreuss over here at the Federal Aviation Administration. And there we were very much involved in thinking about air traffic control in terms of where do we go next? This very distributed system of essentially command and control that had developed over the last 60 years, 70 years, organically, and didn't really, it was capacity limited because of the workload of the air traffic controllers, and still is. So the question there was, how do we exploit machine computation in autonomy to reduce the workload, maybe move into a new regime of supervisory control over machine computation systems, data fusion, data analysis, and control. So, coming back to ONR, I find out that this issue about autonomy is, which I kind of focused on over at Ames, focused on the FAA, it's now a huge thing in the Navy and Marine Corps and DOD in general, the whole move toward what they call network-centric warfare and unmanned systems. So I'm going to talk a little bit about that later. But I mentioned that because I think the good news is that I've seen a lot of different things, and I can extract patterns across different communities. The bad news is that, I'm not an expert in Navy and Marine Corps. I'm probably not an expert in much of anything. So I have a lot to learn where I am right now. So that's by way of introduction. So I would have liked to have said this is ONR's view of what our science and technology goals are, but I'm not really empowered to speak for all the department. So this is ONR 34, which is the number of my department. This is a line from Susan Chipman, one of my mentors when I was at ONR in the 90s. We aim to be consultants of the first resort. And so we'd like to be connected. And you people are in really great position for us to be connected. So a little high-level stuff. I wanted to say that given the economic downturn, there's been a lot of focus on money, the huge deficit that we have, and acquisition reform. And we're part of acquisition. We're the research, development, and acquisition organization, part of that organization for the Department of the Navy. So there's a lot of positive attention being placed toward acquisition reform. But I think that the S&T portion, the science and technology portion, actually is being recognized as an engine for innovation for the economy. And, you know, you can't feel too comfortable with the level of deficits that we have. You can never be complacent. But I do think that we are in a position to move forward and grow, and it's unlikely that we're going to get cut significantly. You know, we get high-level support. The two top-ranking people in the Navy, Marine Corps Chief of Naval Operations, and the Commandant of the Marine Corps, this was before the recession hit, you know, have essentially committed to the growth of S&T. So that's a good thing, and I think the Obama administration agrees with this. This you probably can't see. I don't know if you have handouts, but this is my boss, the Chief of Naval Research, Rear Admiral Nevin Carr. This is our org chart. He reports to the Assistant Secretary of the Navy for Research, Development, and Acquisition. And he's double-hatted. He also reports directly to the Chief of Naval Operations. So he's pretty well positioned. And he's a great guy. He just came on board in December. Underneath Admiral Carr, there are six science and technology departments here. One of them is Warfighter Performance S&T, and that's the one I'm in. Ivy Esterbrook is in ONR 30, which has got a long title, Expeditionary Warfare and Combating Terrorism. Ivy works very closely with us in this whole area of social networking understanding you know, computational organizational design and how that relates to how we make decisions collectively, which again I think is a very interesting aspect of understanding these systems, whether they're medical systems, you know, other operational systems. So I'll talk more about that. We work very collaboratively across departments, as you can imagine, because you know, our interest is how, you know, the person in the system as a critical element of complex systems. So across the board, as a department head, I have a lot of opportunity to discuss those issues and raise those issues with my fellow department heads as they're considering their investment strategies. So again, ONR. ONR was the first federal institution to provide research funding. It was created in 1946 by an act of Congress, and with a mission and charter to be an engine for innovation and support basic research, and also had a strong medical component even back then. The first people that that staffed the National Science Foundation, they were all ONR people. So we have a long history of supporting innovative research, but we also recognize that things change. That NIH is very important, NSF, DARPA, they all have different roles. And so our role is in this kind of sweet spot of strategic research, not curiosity-driven research, and to build these communities that allow us to get new ideas out and to actually work on interesting problem areas that come from the applications and the people that we work with. So in a sense, you know, from one point of view, my boss is really the Chief Naval Operations and the Commandant of the Marine Corps. That's what the Chief Naval Research might say. So our budget, this is the all overall ONR budget. It's in FY10, it was calculated to be about $1.8 billion, a significant amount of money. Unfortunately, we don't get a 1/6 of that in my department. But overall, the portfolio is 40% of it is what we call discovery and innovation. And that is, there are three budget categories, congressional budget categories, that are science and technology. They used to be referred to as 6-1, 6-2, and 6-3, basic research, exploratory development, and advanced technology demonstration. The D&I, discovery and invention, is basic and early applied research, 6-1 and 6-2. It's 40% of the ONR budget. So we also have acquisition enablers. These are like mini acquisition programs for more applied projects that have written agreements that are reviewed rigorously every year with customers who will budget for the follow-on that will enable the transition of our investments. One of the challenges is to link those two. We also have a couple of other areas, but this funding strategy is laid out in the Naval S&T Strategic Plan, which I think, I don't know whether you guys brought that. I
just passed it around.
Okay, so it's in there. And the good news about this is that this plan, which actually has a lot more detail, I'll talk to you just a little bit more about it, has been signed off on by our corporate board, which is the Assistant Secretary of Navy, RDNA, the Vice CNO, and the ACMAC, the Assistant Commandant of the Marine Corps. So a four-star body that says, yeah, we agree. And what that does is that allows us some security, if you will, in being able to invest in both innovative research and bridging to make applications happen. Within the strategic plan, there are 13 focus areas. And this might turn off an academic community because it's kind of hard to see where the science and technology taxonomy is there. But it's really meant to communicate our value to our operational community. I'm the lead for Naval Warfighter Performance. There are overlaps or complementary aspects of many of these. Total ownership cost is a big issue that we're trying to understand. Of course, that's related to the acquisition problem, related to life cycle costs. And the cost of people, particularly aboard ships, is staggering. When you look at it over the 50-year life cycle of a ship, you include the seashore rotation, training, it's enormous medical benefits. So trying to get a handle on that in an environment where it's all about the acquisition costs, not the life cycle costs, that's a big issue for us. Information security and communication, that's about, that whole network-centric aspect. We have access to enormous amounts of information right now. And how do you design systems that explore, synthesize, support actionable decisions by the humans in the system? And so, obviously, there's a big link there. Distributed operations, you know, this is something that's related to kind of Marine Corps thinking about small unit operations. And also asymmetric and irregular warfare. These are things that probably Ivy will speak to a little bit, but we work very closely across the boundary. So it's a little hard to define necessarily the boundaries. So the Naval Warfighter Performance, we broke it out into these sub-objective, or these objective areas, and these reflect to a certain extent the DoD 5000.02, is that what it is now? I got that wrong in a later slide. But so it runs the entire gamut of manpower modeling, you know, for recruitment targets, for projecting what your needs are, and then assigning personnel to the right jobs, providing the right training. And we have some common interests in human systems integration training as an engineering systems engineering domain that we talked about offline yesterday. Human system design, you know, a lot of the, as we all know, HSI training requirements often reflect poor design. So you can reduce the enormous investment we make in training by having better design. Warfighter protection, this extends to, this is a vest. It extends to body armor, but also kind of OSHA-type things like noise-induced hearing loss. In fact, we have a program in noise-induced hearing loss that's kicking off in a big way on October 1st, where you know, the motivation behind that is that the VA spends, in 2006, in FY06, they spent $1.2 billion on disability payments for hearing loss, and another half a billion on hearing aids. And that's just the tip of the iceberg. That's a quality of life issue. That's a cost issue. And Those are things that we need to be paying attention to, and we are. This is really our medical S&T effort, and I'll be talking a little bit more about that. In my department, we really have three different areas. We have medical science and technology, undersea medicine, expeditionary medicine is a big focus. We have human systems integration, which is kind of more than human factors engineering. And then we've got bio-inspired systems, which I'll talk a little bit about. But we're also building robotic systems based on what we know about central nervous system processing in insects, mammals, and also even reverse engineering microbial metabolism to create power sources. So we do things like that. I'm not going to talk about that. So this is just to make sure that we all agree. I think we all know that it's not human factors engineering. It's not just human factors engineering. So I've just skipped through some of these things. I mentioned the personnel costs. I'll talk to that in a second. Reducing the training requirement is a big deal. Lightening the load for small unit operations. That's Marine Corps. These guys are carrying around packs that weigh over 100 pounds in the unbelievable heat. Now we're going into Afghanistan, mountainous terrain, horrendous temperature extremes, water is an issue. Anything that we can do to reduce the physical load on them, we'd like to. And in fact, in our medical side of the house, we're trying to reduce the logistic footprint, for example, by developing automated monitoring technologies for ventilation that take better care of the patients. Because you don't have a corpsman who's sometimes there and sometimes not, and has got five other patients to worry about who are really seriously injured. But you've got an automated system that's titrating the oxygen levels in the blood in real time and reducing the requirement for to bring in tanks of oxygen. In fact, some 50% of the patients that were being evacuated out of Iraq to Germany in the field tests of this didn't even need to be ventilated. So we're doing things like that to focus specifically on the medical aspect of that. Ivy's going to talk about human social cultural, human robotic interaction, and interaction with unmanned and autonomous systems in general, related to command and control. How do you develop a command and control system that's not hierarchical and dependent on individual humans, but that maybe will bound the behavior of machine elements. And of course, this has been getting a lot of attention with the aviation weapons that they're using essentially in Iraq. Data fusion, we've already talked about most of this stuff, so I'll just go ahead. Talked about most of that. So, and what I'm gonna do now is just kind of quickly flip through, give you a taste of some of the projects that we're working on. So if you think about human autonomy interaction, you can think of it in a lot of different ways. I mean, you can even think of it as human elements being autonomous elements, so that in a normal command and control architecture, you'd have somebody that's in charge of somebody else, and they're delegating responsibility to that person as an agent in a multi-agent system, just human to human. You can also think about remotely operated aircraft, or systems. This is actually an unmanned surface vehicle on the ocean. And then, if you really want to exploit machine capability, you want to push down as much autonomy as you can. So at this first level of closed-loop control of sea vehicles, we have a new ship called the Littoral Combat Ship, which has a modular architecture, and one of the modules is controlling. Actually, there's several different kinds of craft that are unmanned craft that they need to be controlling, perhaps in a very cluttered harbor environment. So it's really a hard problem. And their goal is to have one person controlling four craft. And their initial design was not even allowing one person to control one craft. This doesn't usually involve offensive weapons, but... even then, just getting situation awareness, when you're looking through the soda straw of a video camera or something like that, it's a very difficult problem. So that's one of the things that we're working on is enabling better closed-loop control automated unmanned vehicles. Then we're also working with a little bit further out. We are building these kind of robotic systems based on what we know about sensory neural processing, sensory motor processing, and biological systems. We like to be able to interact with them in a hands-free environment, so that you could point over there, and they'd recognize a gesture and have a kind of a natural language underpinning to understand what a gesture means, just as you would with natural language. Speech recognition, gesture recognition. We're also going to the next step of thinking about building robotic systems that are really true teammates, team members. So trying to embed social cognition, biometrics, so the ability to anticipate information that we've learned from team decision-making is really critical for effective team performance. Even to the point of over here, we're working on, I'm sure we're not the only person that's funding Cynthia Brazil up at MIT with Nexi, but actual social robots that are able to communicate facially and express emotion and a lot of content that is important to optimal team performance. And in general, we've had a couple of workshops sponsored by ONR across ONR, so this is a corporate priority, on autonomy. And one of the things I was pleased about remains to be seen whether it'll be expressed programmatically, but at the workshops, people really recognize that the importance of the human element and the challenge of the human element as you're exploiting autonomy and autonomous systems. So that's something I'm going to be pushing forward on. And in fact, that's a reminder. I believe that we'll be able to hire somebody. I'll be looking for somebody that can fit a niche here that can address autonomy and include it in the new ways of thinking about command and control. So this is something that links the past with the future. I think there's a couple people who might have seen something like this, but this was my capture, my own view of computational human performance understanding at ONR. So back in the, you can't see here, is probably 1985 to today. Back in the early 80s, Susan Chipman was really a pillar of this stuff. Was important in creating a cognitive science community. And that's what really our business is. Similar to kind of what your business might be in this committee, is creating community. So here we have this cognitive science community where people like John Anderson and, the Pittsburgh Mafia got funded to develop testable, executable simulations of human information processing that were based on psychologically plausible principles, like ACT-R. And that was tested out with intelligent tutors. Well, that turns out that's got some legs. That's something that's very useful for the Navy. And also, it turned out that we began to think that we might be able to use these models of individuals and use them in an engineering context. Just like we do simulation for structures, well, maybe we can do simulations for human-machine interaction. Then, around the 1988 Vincennes incident, where the USS Vincennes shot down an Iranian airliner, the first analysis of that, Trish Hamburger was one of the civilians that could brief us out. The initial analysis of that was that this automated system actually worked really well, and the only problem was that we didn't shoot down the airliner 10 minutes earlier. Obviously, that's the wrong answer, right? So that really made us, I think, as a community, reflect more about the nature of team decision making in a complex, serial environment. And so we had this tactical decision making under stress program, which also had a computational basis started developing team models. And some of that work was going on already at the Army with microanalysis design and other folks, but I've been happy to see that these initial investments have contributed to an industry of human systems engineering services, products and services, tools, and people that will do work like that for a buck. We used to be supporting people both within our regular programs and within the Small Business Innovative Research Program you know, there used to be a group of companies, small companies, that was their whole business, was to get phase one and phase two SBIRs, where our business was to get them out of the phase two and actually have an impact, develop commercial products, and that's actually happened. So this this formal approach to human performance modeling at the team level led to a new program, again, a 6-1 program, which was called Adaptive Architectures for Command and Control. But here we were kind of leveraging the knowledge about computational approaches to team cognition, team decision making, and extending that to computational organizational design, a new field that didn't exist in 1994 and 1996, whenever it started. So, and you all know people like Kathleen Carley and other folks that were supported that. Well, that had also Navy and Marine Corps relevance in designing optimal command and control architectures for distributed teams, like people on different ships, trying to figure out how to optimize the allocation of like sensor assets, ISR assets. But it also puts us in a position that, how do you understand what an organization actually is? And that led us into a position. We had an anthropologist, Rebecca Goolsbee, who's still with us, that was working in this A2C2 program. And after 9/11, people became very interested in terrorist networks. And that kind of led to the stuff that Ivy's going to talk to, but that we're also pursuing social cultural modeling theory. So right now, we're at the 6-1 level here. Trouble with this work, there's a couple problems with it as an area of science and research. One is that, first of all, if you get people out in the field, it turns out that the information they provide is so operationally useful that it immediately gets sucked up into the warfighting thing. It's not really a research project. The other is that it's dangerous. You know, it's dangerous for researchers. And but it's extremely interesting. And I think one of the things that the Army's been working this with their human terrain teams, one of the interesting observations that I've heard from them is that when you put an anthropologist in the field to try and understand, you know, how do tribal customs work and communications and all this, what you really learn is that you don't know enough about how people on the friendly side, you know, work. And in order to be able to understand and what Ivy might talk about to out-tempo the terrorist network and out-adapt them, you really have to understand, from my point of view, how your own processes work, which we don't. So it's just a fascinating area. So I won't go through this. Ivy will talk to this. It's related to this whole command and control issue. I don't know if you've heard of C4 ISR. It's command, control, communications, computers, intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance. It used to be just C2, and then became C3, C3, and then a C4. But now that people have moved on to think about network-centric warfare or interactions, some people are even saying, well, maybe we shouldn't call it control. We're not really in control here. And maybe it's about collaboration, and we have to start thinking about it differently. Because we're so connected, in my mind, as a former insider going outside and then coming back, you know, it's hard for me to think even of the ship as a platform anymore because it's so distributed. There's remote presence. We're working with the submarine community and meteorological information processing to figure out, you know, what the underwater environment is going to be like, what the sensors are going to look like, things like that. That's a sparse environment for sensors. You have to position your assets, whether they're submarines or ships or whatever, and it may take some time to do that. It's a kind of different ball game. And then you throw in what are being called unmanned systems, which of course aren't unmanned. You know, there is autonomy, but then there has to be boundary conditions around their behavior. That's this new area that I think we're getting into. So part of that is just decision support. So one of the things that goes on, for example, this is a mine warfare area. program that we have a future naval capability. People are trying to get information for strategic and operational decisions that rely on information that needs to be fresh because it's a very dynamic environment. It can take 12 hours to get that information up there, and it's dated by the time they get up there. And so what we're doing is really developing more efficient knowledge management systems that will automate this to the extent possible, but really provide the information that's being provided by experts who are busy down below decks, with their PowerPoint laptops, working things out. So this is a whole area of decision support that I think is very general. There's a linkage into computer science side of the world with the service-oriented architectures that are being developed that would provide general services, some of which we'll be addressing here, and then some mission-specific services. So those kinds of things that we're interested in. I'll skip that. And I already mentioned this. This is kind of satisfying. This also relates to our interest over there at the FAA. Weather is the biggest disruptor of air traffic and civilian air traffic. It's chaotic. It's a chaotic system. You can't really predict when it's going to pop up. We've got aircraft trying to find a way through. It's very hard to plan a complex system like civilian aviation. Well, it turns out that that's a problem that you can attack brute force wise, but there's a point of diminishing returns in terms of the predictive power of really good forecasting capabilities. This is down there at the Tier 1 level. And the commander of the Naval Oceanographic and Meteorological Command out in Stennis had this idea that, we're really doing good work here, but we really want to be able to have more useful information that will be, from 1 day to 5 days in order to be able to position assets and stuff. So what we really need is a decision layer. And it's very similar to what's going on at the FAA, or at least what was going on at the FAA a year and a half ago, and thinking about how to do decision-making and planning based on what you think the weather is going to be doing. And that relates, there are a lot of different strategies. So the notion here, the guy that was the commander down in Stennis, Mississippi, is now the oceanographer of the Navy. So this is probably going to keep going for a while. The idea here is that some central location could provide information that would be tailored for the operational mission requirements and could be sent out as a useful and iterative process with the commanders in the field, or in this case, on the water or under the water. So that's an exciting part. Training is a sort of a bread and butter area for us. And, of course, we talked a little bit about that with intelligent tutoring systems and cognitive task analysis, reducing the training requirement. With the computational power that we have now, we're really able to do a lot more kind of more realistic kind of training. And I'm not somebody who's looking for high fidelity as a panacea for training problems. But it is a different kind of capability to be able to generate a scenario that has training points embedded in it and allow people to experience, a complex system that they wouldn't be able to experience otherwise. So that could be a laptop, that could be a fully immersive virtual environment. A big challenge for us right now is team interactions. How do you represent the variance associated with individuals on a team computationally? Or maybe a simpler way would be just to link two people training together. This was a nice project because it addressed some of the sensitivities about marine mammal vulnerability with mid-frequency acoustic training that was taking place out in off the coast of Southern California. And there's a lot we can do by simulation, and that's one of the things that we were able to do proactively, anticipating a requirement. This was a project that went from a good idea to actual deliverable. Harold Hawkins was the guy that did it in about 4 years. And it showed that, ONR can be both, can both be responsive and anticipate requirements and be flexible about getting there. A lot of emphasis on game-based training. Everybody's talking about games and, how motivating that is and how the millennial generation process information. I don't really believe that, but it is possible to provide training environments that use commercial game-based infrastructure to be able to address real needs and to enable. It's kind of like doing computational fluid dynamics for wind tunnels. It's not like you're really putting the wind tunnels out of business, but they're expensive. And you want to optimize your time there. Well, similarly, with real live training or major mock-ups, you want to do that efficiently as well. So this is a way of doing that. This is a Art Kramer slide. Art's not here.
Because of weather, he's not here.
Because of weather, that's right. See, we need better decision support and planning tools. Actually, I could have told him to come yesterday. This is just an example of some of the more far out work that we're doing. So most of us, as those of us that are psychologists and know something about the history of testing of intelligence, knows that there's something that had been called Spearman's G, fluid intelligence, that seemed to be innate and was a information processing limitation that explains certain kinds of individual differences in intelligence. And that the work by Marcel Just and Pat Carpenter really kind of did a lot of meta-analysis and figured out the Ravens progressive matrices was the one test, I won't go into it, but that really was well correlated with a lot of different kinds of other tests that purported to look at that. What Art Kramer and John Janitis and some other folks have discovered is that with certain kinds of strategic game exposure, you can actually change the performance on this Ravens progressive matrices and also with attention switching time. This is really heretical for the community. I have a hard time believing it myself. But there's a number of things that we might want to do, that we are going to do to explore, whether that's a general effect. Is it persistent? Is it real? It's kind of hard to believe. But it might have real training implications. So human systems design, my colleague Bob Beaton at the Naval Sea Systems Command, in his role as a technical warrant holder, they oversee manning requirements on our ships and our submarines. We're finding that that we really are not that good at it, actually. We'd like to be much more specific about the impacts of certain human design questions. Frequency in our high speed craft, people are getting bounced around. We're delivering Marines to the beach, can't even walk. These kinds of things we need to be able to capture computationally to make informed decisions in design and be more efficient. And some of these models, this happens to be a model of this spinal cord and kind of a physical model. But it's this kind of stuff also is related to how do we design body armor for Marines and protective environments. I mentioned this already about noise-induced hearing loss. We are working at noise reduction. Was stimulated in part by the Joint Strike Fighter engine noise, which some people think is going to be 165 dB at the flight deck on our aircraft carriers. 165 dB.
Jesus.
No, what do you do about that? How does that noise propagate across the ship? An interesting problem here, and I have a background in speech and hearing sciences, so this is a particular interest of mine, but one of the questions is that the OSHA standards were developed for 8 hours of exposure and 16 hours of quiet time. But you don't have any quiet time on the ships. So one of the things that we're exploring is whether anybody knows about recovery time and what the right standards would be for 24/7 operations. And they don't have it for impulse noise, too. That's another issue. So that's an interesting program. We're actually been empowered to address medical aspects. So we have some investments that are looking at support cell transformation in the inner ear to turn support cells into hair cells, because the hair cells are what are destroyed in some kinds of noise-induced hearing loss. So, exciting program. We're also really approaching the limits of the physics in personal protection equipment. Various kinds of noise cancellation that will allow us to do dosimetry aboard ships with these in-canal things, so we actually know what the noise exposure is. A lot of fun and interesting stuff. And this is the last section, and I hope we're doing okay time-wise. One of my challenges when I came to ONR was to kind of put my medical science and technology portfolio on a better footing. And part of the problem was that everybody's interested in medical, but there weren't a lot of champions, and they weren't speaking with one voice. And so I think we've got a critical set of people that are sitting at the same table, and that table happens to be the integrated product team that oversees our Force Health Protection Future Naval Capability, one of those more applied programs. And we invited the Navy Surgeon General, Admiral Robinson, to talk to us this past February. It was the first time, I think, that Surgeon General had ever been at the Office of Naval Research. glad we took care of that one. But this is the concept. And from an operational point of view, medical is a showstopper. When you take hits, our Marines in the field, their first duty is to save their buddies. And, we have to be thinking about what the operational consequences are of medical vulnerability, not to mention the quality of life issues and disability payments, I guess just the costs. I won't go into great detail, but I think this is, the ABCs of point of injury care. So that would be airway, breathing, and circulation. We do a lot of work on treating hemorrhagic shock, which is the number one killer of people on the battlefield. You want to extend the golden hour. That's a real issue for deployed forces that don't have a big logistics tail, like in our small unit operations. How do we get people out? We were doing things like pharmacological resuscitation, injections of vasopressin, which we've shown with the two large animal models, will reduce the mortality associated with internal bleeding, and also extend the time that they can be treated. I mentioned this closed-loop ventilation before. We're doing things with fluid delivery. Same kind of concept is that a lot of times people are over-treated, especially burn patients. They have too much fluid, and we need to do that better. We're developing oxygen generation systems that are green. We've got a little package of hydrogen peroxide, put a little manganese in it, shake it up, and it produces oxygen and water. It's great. So those are the kinds of things that actually this is something I think it might be useful as an alternative to the current oxygen canisters in commercial aviation. They're not exothermic. Also this whole issue about casual evacuation. So the idea one of the game changers people are talking about is developing. I'm sorry, it's down low. Is developing. Logistics supply through unmanned aerial vehicles, and once they drop off the supplies, well, they're empty. Well, maybe we can use them to get people out. And I know there's some issues that the FAA might not approve of, but when you look at the baseline of people dying in the battlefield, it's probably a good idea. So we're exploring that. And all those technologies, automated medical monitoring technologies, could be applied in emergency med techs in civilian life. Could be on a truck getting people out of there. It could be in manned aircraft, too. So I think all of these things will work together. So, this is the last medical one, and then I'll have a summary slide. We have the world leadership for undersea medicine, and we are working on things like right now, if you've got bends, the best therapy is a decompression chamber. Well, those are big, expensive, and not very portable. So one of the things we're looking at is the mechanisms of decompression illness, and among other things, and trying to see whether or not we can treat it pharmacologically, so you, at least get people through this initial stage so that they can be okay without the decompression chamber. So that's the development of non-recompression therapies for disabled submarine escapees, for example. Anyhow, so there's more interesting stuff here. I guess I have to stop talking. So basically, what we've got at ONR right now is that I believe that there is strong support for science and technology in general as an engine for innovation. HSI at ONR is getting a high level of scrutiny, and I think actually has real opportunity to grow as I, you know, kind of work with my fellow department heads. And these are different areas, just a subset of some of the exciting areas that are open for growth. So I guess it's lunchtime. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Terry. We have a few minutes for questions.
Kind of a monologue.
Yes.
Could you say?
Sure.
How do you understand computational human systems modeling?
How do you approach it?
Yeah.
It could be Air Force.
So there's several different ways to approach it, and I think our investments reflect all of them. So you can approach it from a first principles point of view psychologically and build up an architecture that reflects what we know about human information processing. You know, a hippocampal complex, cortical things, working memory, executive control, parallel processing. So that's one way, and that has certain benefits. You can approach it at a different level of behavior. So you can look at perhaps team interactions. You can model the environment, task network models that may or may not be able to make predictions at a high level of granularity, but will predict the behavior of the team. And then these organizational models, which are really, they're just general, they make generalizations about the kind of behavior. And then the big issue, and that's scaling up to the kind of terrorist network modeling, is it becomes harder and harder to validate those models as you move upward in the level of behavioral complexity. So, those are just... That's kind of a handful of ways we approach that.
I'm a guest, so I'll moderate my comments, but I was deeply troubled by some parts of your talk, especially focusing on autonomous systems. And it seems to ignore the 20 or 30-year history analysis, Tom Sheridan's work on supervisory systems, Chuck Billings of NTSB, who reports system autonomy kills.
You know, NASA Ames.
He was the head of his NTSB.
His book, Charles Aviation, Billing?
Was aviation automation. And the point is that the focus that you gave about autonomous mm-hmm. systems, and I'm troubled also by your joking reference to the Vincennes tragedy, but there's a serious issue, and the notion of human responsibility as part of design, I would like to see more explicitly raised as part of these systems, because the direction you were charting troubles me as not only counterproductive, but dangerous.
Well, I certainly would be very interested. I certainly don't want to make light of anything as serious as human life. And I really feel that deeply. So if I gave that impression, my apologies, that was not intended. As far as the direction, I meant to be supportive of the notion of many years of important work in supervisory control. And I didn't go into any technical detail about how we might approach that. I am aware that there are different levels of autonomy is one way of thinking about that. All I meant to state is that this is a challenge that has emerged as an important technical area, and I'd like to be educated about the right way to approach the problem.
I'd like to suggest that autonomy is not a positive goal. So that increasing human control mm-hmm. and enabling and empowering the decision maker is a more effective way. Mm-hmm. And that if you make the lines of responsibility clear, it'll make the design better. That if you address liability and accountability, and you know, military line of control issues and rules of engagement as part of a human social system. You later alluded to the collaboration, which makes me a little bit more happy, but those parts earlier were free of that discussion. And I just hope that at every stage and with your researchers, you can find ways to make human responsibility for failures as important an issue as increasing the potential power of the operator.
I couldn't agree with you more. And actually, I tried to state that right up front in my vision slide, if you will, where I think I said something like automation and technology will not replace human ingenuity, creativity, and autonomy. I agree. I think we're all probably on the same page, even though I maybe didn't express it well enough. My feeling is that in current complex systems, people are what provide resilience to those systems. And I think this whole area of system resilience is something that could be addressed. The accountability issue is huge. You know, nobody's going to sue a software system. And I think that was proven out in the Vincennes case, actually, because I didn't mean to be flip, and again, I apologize by that, but it was initially, people said, well, the system did work the way it was supposed to do it, and from an autonomy point of view. And in fact, that was the wrong answer, that what you really need to do was to understand how information is passed serially and transformed, and you know, sort of a source amnesia for you know, where the information came, what the quality of the information was, and that you know, that's one of the general challenges that we face with complex systems. I would argue that people categorize information, and that's how they deal with complex environments. But you know, I'm not an expert, and what I'm here to do today is to open up some of these questions for criticism and for, you know, to get your best ideas of how we should be thinking about these things.
Tom? You just raised the question of network-centric, or you discussed that a little bit, and I know that's the push in a lot of military systems. And my reading is that network-centric things, the way they've been operating so far, have not necessarily worked out very well in many cases. I don't know. I guess there's plenty of effort being devoted to understanding failure modes in network-centric communication between people and computers and so on. Is that a defined topic, in the failure of networks? Is that part of command and control thinking?
I mean, the real answer is I'm not sure what the current thinking is. I know network-centric warfare was a slogan that was popularized back in the mid-90s, recognizing the fact that there was opportunity to gather information and make decisions from distributed resources, whether those are people or not.
There's a big effort, a joint program, it's Army collaboration with the Brits on this kind of thing going on. I've been kibitzing with them a little bit, and it's technology-driven. I mean, you can sort of see that this is kind of picking up on Ben's point. You can see the proponents of technology are pushing the network thing as hard as they can, and there are some people are sort of saying, whoa, you know, a little bit here. One of my favorite authors is Norbert Wiener's last book. You may know about God and Golem Incorporated. I don't know how many of you know that. It's just lovely because one of the things he worried about in his dying days was how computers can do things when they're, you know, big computers, big systems, they can do what they're programmed to do, but that's not always what was intended. Mm-hmm. And that whole question, and I think it's a researchable question, and it definitely involves human factors and human system integration.
And it's not just technology, it's not human and technology, but it's human to human as well. I mean, part of the challenge is people who have the right information, how do you get them together so they can synthesize that information and act on it when I don't know you? if I don't know you, how do I trust you? So there are a lot of elements that get into this. Same thing with the, you know, if it's technology interface, how do I know that I can trust the information? So, you know, the systems are coming. So I think the challenge for behavioral science in this is to really be able to think about what are the limits, you know, what are some of the breakdown points, but also how you can enhance or leverage and solve those problems.
And, you know, we'll always be fighting these battles that, you know, people want to replace humans with autonomy and autonomous systems. And I agree that that's the wrong way to think about it. And, you know, that's where I am trying to make a difference in continually raising this issue. With these autonomous system workshops, as I was saying, I was happy to see that this whole issue of the role of the human in autonomous systems was raised at both workshops. And the question, that's why I was saying, I'm hoping that we'll be able to capitalize on that and express that programmatically. But it's a fight, because the tendency is to focus on the autonomy. There was a recent Strategic Studies Group report on unmanned systems. It was briefed to the Chief of Naval Operations. And it was a little discouraging from that point of view, because people talk about machine speed and all this, but and I'm having this very direct argument with a fellow department head who's sort of in charge of computer science, C4ISR system. You know, you're never going to be in a position, and nor would you want to be, where you're creating fully autonomous systems. What you're going to be is this hybrid force concept, where there's autonomous systems, which already exist, you know, at some level, and humans interacting either at the same level, you know, possibly underneath some sort of machine direction, or more likely to be above them. But there's always going to be a human that's accountable in the chain. You have to really understand the big issue at the FAA is figuring out the accountability in an automated system where we had air traffic controllers that were depending on software analysis of how you ought to be managing the traffic. So it's a very common issue, and you know, there's no simple answer to it. But it's something that we continually want to raise as an issue as a community, I would say.
Well, with that, I think it's time for lunch. So thank you very much, Terry.
Can I say something? During this lunch, we hope people will talk to each other and whatever. I know Terry has to get back to ONR, and I want to just tell you, of course, DC cab drivers can never navigate Arlington, but Arlington drivers can here. So anyway, I know you have to, you know, move on quickly.